You're listening to Spellbound. Welcome to episode 23 of Spellbound. I'm Julian Smith. Spellbound is now a CastBox original. You can still listen to it anywhere else you typically listen to podcasts, but check out CastBox today and see what's making it the fastest growing and highest rated podcast app for both iOS and Android. All right, I'm here today with Ramona Pringle.
Hello.
Ramona, thanks for being here today.
Oh, you're welcome. This is great.
And also Andrew Rader again.
I'm back.
You're the most regular guest on this show. So Ramona, you're an interesting person. You're a producer, an actress, a journalist, and a professor.
I'm more of those things now and less of some of those other things now. Actress is something that was sort of an early career of mine. These days, I'm a professor. I'm a professor of media and interaction design. I actually run an incubator at the university as well. I'm at Ryerson University in Toronto and run a lab there called the Transmedia Zone, which is innovation in media journalism, sort of where technology touches on all of the kind of creative industries. And then I do a weekly column for CBC on technology, but not sort of the gadget side of it, more like how is this touching our lives? How is it changing our relationship with each other and the world around us?
So you guys are actually studying the effects of technology on a social level.
Exactly.
That's cool.
And what's CBC? Because I'm Canadian, but most people aren't.
CBC is Canadian Broadcast. It's like the BBC, only in Canada.
Okay.
Has, you know, great national radio, great online presence. I have to say, one of the things that I love about the radio column that I do is that it's syndicated, which means that every week I speak to 20 different markets. And when you talk about technology stories, I think this is really part of why I do it. What I really enjoy about it is so often tech stories feel like it's one and done. And, you know, it comes out of New York, it comes out of Silicon Valley, it comes out of Toronto. And it's a sort of massive story where the assumption is that it touches everyone the same way. And it really doesn't. And so one of the stations that I speak to is Iqaluit in the very, very, very far north. You know, I speak to Vancouver, I speak to Ottawa. And so you've got, you know, to put it in American terms, that's like speaking to Washington and your political hub, and then speaking to California, where there's, you know, one sort of political bent or different interests, maybe more creative, speaking to New York. You're speaking to these different markets,
right,
with different hosts, and understanding that, you know, far up north, they have got connectivity issues. They've got broadband issues, mm-hmm, that there's sort of different cultural factors, different environmental factors. And that's really fascinating, just understanding that the nuance of a story changes depending on who you're talking to.
It's the equivalent of northern Alaska in Iqaluit, basically.
Right. Yeah. Very far north.
And you've got your bachelor's with honors in film and video production from York University and your master's in interactive media from NYU, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I went through a program at NYU called ITP, the Interactive Telecommunications Program, which was definitely something I would do again if I ever got time to just sink two more years into school. That was an amazing, amazing program.
Right. And I guess Andrew, having a PhD from MIT, that makes me the dumbest person in the room. also the only American. I guess it shouldn't be a surprise that I'm the dumbest person in the room because I'm American.
I'm waiting for Andrew to say something.
I just realized neither of you are allowed to laugh at that joke that I just made.
Right, we're too polite.
It's okay for you to laugh at that.
I'm sorry, Julian.
Yeah,
I'm also very sorry.
We're all sorry Julian is American. So today we're talking about the hottest commodity on the planet. That is your personal data. Seems like you've got a lot to say about that, Ramona.
Yeah, absolutely I do. I mean, I think that it's one of those topics where every single week there seems to be multiple headlines, there seems to be multiple controversies, and just really thinking about, I think for people, for the public to be thinking about what our data means or data means, you know, who is profiting off of it, what sort of control we have over it or should have over it, you know, what it means for our kids and implications there. I just think there's so much there. And I should say, you know, part of my approach to all of this is making these topics relevant and accessible to everybody, not just the people who work in tech, not just the people who feel like, you know, they're super, super smart and study this and read journals, but everybody, because, you know, there's over 2 billion people on Facebook, which means that those 2 billion people ought to understand the implications of the sort of social exchange, this barter that we're all a part of.
Personal data and privacy is something I'm really passionate about. It's such a fascinating problem because the thing that is driving it all is people's addiction. Like, people are giving up their personal information willingly on like Facebook and, mm-hmm, Twitter and Instagram because they're addicted. They're just forfeiting all this information about themselves. And then these companies are then in turn turning the people who are forfeiting their information into a product that it's just like, it's just this endless loop of like being bought and sold. You're basically a slave if you're, if you're addicted to these things. And it's no different than, you actually wrote an article on how it's no different than tobacco, and you compared it to the tobacco controversy of the mid-century.
Yeah, interesting. And also, you know, one of the other articles that I wrote that struck a chord, which was almost a year ago now, was looking at how data's become the new oil.
Right.
And when you look at the sort of the most profitable companies in the world, the sort of the old guard of what was profitable has been displaced by Google and Facebook and Apple. And, you know, these are the companies that are worth just billions and
trillions for Apple.
Trillions. And they're doing it with, they're doing it with just this, it's so amorphous. It's so hard to wrap our head around what that product is, but it's us, it's our information. And, you know, what do we get out of it? We do get that sort of hit of oxytocin, that feels so good. We get that connection. I think it is very hard for any of us to step away from it because we have such strong desires to connect with each other and to know what each other are doing, to be part of a community that maybe we aren't getting the way we once did in our offline lives. It's fascinating just to see what a valuable commodity data has become, and the fact that other people own us, other people own our data is fascinating. And yeah, I wrote about it sort of looking at it like the tobacco industry, big tobacco, following the Cambridge Analytica scandal, just wondering like, when is that moment going to come when we realize, this isn't necessarily that good for us? And there is this, you know, huge industry that's profiting off of this. You know, when we think about cigarettes, when we think about smoking now, I think most of us kind of go, ew, but there was a time when, you know, the Marlboro man was a pop culture figure.
Everybody wanted to be the Marlboro man.
Smoking was sexy, and people in, you know, James Dean and all of these, you know, even Breakfast Club, like, it was a thing that people did, and I think weren't questioning. And you just wonder, we don't know how we're going to look back at this moment in 20 years.
Yeah, I'm not sure that people necessarily care if their data is being used in these ways. Facebook, we had this scandal just a month or two ago when it was revealed the full extent at which people could micro-target with ads and the Cambridge Analytical scandal. But Facebook got a lot of bad press for a week or two. Its stocks went way down, but they've fully recovered. And I don't think people really cared. I don't think it's really impacted their user base. People have always been subject to ads. And I think the feeling is, why do I care if they're targeting me with ads? In fact, if they're targeting me with ads that you know, appeal to me, then maybe that's actually better. So there's some benefit here.
I totally think you're right. You know, on one hand, I feel like I'm critical of the digital world and the, you know, the world of social media. And yet I love it. I consume it. I don't step away. And I certainly, you know, I'm not anti-tech. I think I'm totally pro-tech. In fact, you know, a lot of the early work that I did, documentary work, journalistic work, was really looking at what that allure is. You know, that we're not addicted to the gadget. We're not addicted to the tech. It is that connection. It is the sort of people on the other side of it. And I think if you look at it with empathy, it's, you understand why we're so drawn to all of this and why we don't want to step away from it. And add on to that the fact that, yeah, you get these great ads that show you exactly what you're looking for. I right now get targeted with fashion that I quite often like, with baby goods that I quite often like. You know, I buy things off of Facebook and Instagram because they know me so, so well. So I think you're absolutely right. And I think that there was an interesting response in the face of Cambridge Analytica, which was, you know, people saying, well, I'm going to leave the platform. I'm going to change my privacy settings on the platform. I don't think that people
it doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, I don't think that
changing your privacy settings doesn't really do anything.
And
Facebook still has access to all of it, and they use it against you. That only changes how other people on the platform can see your information. Mm-hmm. You're still susceptible to ad targeting and stuff like that. So people are forfeiting their data willingly in exchange for this addiction getting fueled, and then they don't care. Like you said, Andrew, they don't care. So I guess the question is it actually bad?
Well, it's an opportunity. So the reason it exists is because the internet is so different from previous ways people advertise. Like when the printing press came about, people advertised in pamphlets, and then television and radio. Those are all one to many. It's broadcasting, right? So it's a message that goes out. There's an opportunity to advertise to everyone at the same time, but you can't really micro-target, and you don't collect information about the people who are seeing that. So there's no feedback. So the internet is a closed system with a feedback loop, so you can see what people are looking at and you can reach them individually. It's many to many, so you can target them with specific ads, And you can also gather data about them to find out what ads are most effective, find out what they click on, find out what their interests are. So you can micro-target them to a staggering degree. And this creates an opportunity, and just having it be the free market means that people will always exploit these economic opportunities. So unless we institute controls that prevent doing things like this, it's really just a factor of the technology that we're going to have data collected by companies and we're going to be subjected by ads in this way. So the only way to stop, and I don't actually know if there is a way to stop too, because the internet is basically outside of any one government's control, relatively unregulated.
Well,
this is the way Silicon Valley wants it. Well, I don't think it's actually kind of beyond the ability to control. In the 90s, the U.S. Congress tried to institute a number of controls on the internet, and basically the response from Silicon Valley was basically like, F you.
They're still trying.
Well, absolutely, they're still trying. And to some extent, in the sense of being able, whether you can regulate how much data. But that's at the server level. That's basically they're trying to allow companies that provide internet services to control how much bandwidth you get.
Right.
But that's not the same thing as trying to censor anything on the internet.
Well, there is the GDPR right now, which is interesting.
Yeah.
And I would say, you know, just to step back for a second, you know, I think when we pose it as, I think everybody always wants to say, like, is this good or is this bad? You know, is this going to save us or is this going to ruin us? Is Facebook, you know, the best thing on earth or the worst? And, you know, because it is such an integral part of our lives, we can't ask that kind of black and white question. The conversations that I'm interested in having are making sure that the people who are using it are empowered. I'm not out to have anyone quit Facebook, because I'm not about to quit Facebook. You know, I use these tools, but I think it's important to know what we're dealing with. And
yeah,
the more that the public becomes aware of the sort of how this works, how all of it works, the nuance of how it works, the business model even, you know, to make the assumption that everyone is aware of the fact that, you know, they're making their money off of you, that, you know, if you're not paying for something on the internet, that you are the product, you are having how they're making their money. You know, I think we can't make the assumption that all those 2 billion plus Facebook users actually understand that. And as people understand it, I think there may be more pressure to push back a little bit over the idea that, you know, maybe you do own your profile. Maybe you could port your profile from one platform to another when, you know, Facebook goes down the tubes, if and when, and maybe, you know, look, MySpace was huge and it went away. You know, that's fueled some of the conversations around blockchain. But there's another one where, you know, people don't understand it. And not to get in, you know, not to go off on a tangent here, but I think, you know, the people who are, you know, huge Bitcoin blockchain proponents right now, I think are quite enamored with jargon and are quite enamored with the fact that people don't understand it. Whereas there is a way to explain it so that the broader public would understand it.
Yeah, blockchain is not that hard to understand. It's really simple.
Right. I think
it's just decentralized information processing.
Yeah.
Right. And if anyone has ever used Google Docs with another person in another place, they basically understand the premise. And so once people understand that, then they might start to understand how they could have a bit more control over that, their data as well. They could have a bit more control over their personal information. And blockchain at this stage may not be the answer for social networks. But I do think that that idea of information as power is sort of the dynamic of the digital world. If data is the new oil, then, you know, information is power. And that's right. What the public needs to have. So I don't think it's a matter of good or bad. I think it's just a matter of, you know, just the same way we need information to be able to vote for the right candidate in an election, which there's a loaded statement.
I think you're right. It's not a matter of good or bad. Is this good? Is this bad? I think 10 years from now, we're going to look back on these conversations and be like, oh, well, we thought that was the end of the world. But I don't think people can help but looking at this in terms of good or bad right now, because mm-hmm. anytime you invent anything new that's disruptive, people are going to say, is this good or bad? Because we have to figure out how it fits into society mm-hmm. without blowing everything up.
Mm-hmm.
So this, I think it's good that we look at this in terms of good or bad so that we can figure out where the pitfalls are and where the advantages are so that we can have a conversation about it publicly.
I'm very supportive of conversations around regulation. It is complicated. I mean, mm-hmm. 2 billion people is bigger than the population of any country on this planet. So to be able to have an individual government trying to enforce something that's bigger than they are, that has more money than they do. You know, whether it's Google, whether it's Facebook, I mean, these could be the countries of, there's a whole other model we could think of that's borderless, but it's driven by these corporate entities. And that's where I think the chilling side of all of this comes in, is corporate control, is private mm-hmm. ownership of people. And that, you know, as much trouble as any individual, at least I'd say Western government may have, certainly, you know, looking at the U.S. right now, things are complicated. The government is still there to, you know, we have some kind of control over it. When we're voting, when there's democracy, it's different than having a corporation running your life.
You're saying it's different having the government run things than a corporation?
I mean, that's...
Isn't the government just a corporation?
I mean, I think that the I'm speaking as a Canadian, but I think that the premise is, you know, you've got an organization, you've got a, you know, the government is there to... Maybe I'm getting myself down a little bit of a rabbit hole here.
No,
but, you know,
no, this is interesting.
Looking
go for
at,
it.
You know,
like, down the rabbit hole we
down
go.
Down the rabbit hole of, like, you know, infrastructure. That's really where I think of the, you know, the value of a government is infrastructure. It's highways. It helps us get from one place to another. It's streetlights.
I see. Amenities. You know,
it's amenities. It's education. It's healthcare.
I see what you're saying.
You know, and that is very different than, you know, having a corporation step in where it's all for profit. You know, we vote based on what is going to be best for us, for our families, for our communities. That's the premise that's there. And so, you know, that's, I think, where it becomes chilling and very sort of dystopian sci-fi when we think about it being taken over by corporations. But it's very challenging for individual governments to try and step up to these very powerful corporations. What's interesting right now is the GDPR that's just been passed, which is, you know, the EU's new privacy laws. And this has been passed whereby all of the European countries that are part of the EU have to, you know, hold up these new privacy laws, which are pretty, you know, pretty strong, pretty powerful. And again, you know, when we look at the fact that money talks, the fines are up to 20 billion euros for companies that are non-compliant. And that's where, you know, I think on day one, Google and Facebook were slapped with some very, very hefty fines.
So one of those regulations is the right to be able to remove your own data if you're oppressed, right? Is that something that's even really possible with the internet?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you can't do that in the internet. I mean, everything is uploaded.
There's all kinds of dark corners. And
yeah, I mean, there's that huge warehouse in Utah that the government just built that's like the size of 6 IKEAs, and it's just a giant server farm. They have enough server space to collect over 100 gigabytes of data on every American.
It's possible to delete data from certain sites, but not necessarily removed from the internet. The other thing is actually data is generally not deleted ever anymore because it's cheaper to just build more data storage than it is to delete data. So we just keep adding more data storage. That's
we're
how the
screwed.
World works. So we just accumulate it. Like, I mean, every second we probably accumulate more data, more photographs than the entire 18th century, 19th century, basically.
And also I think, you know, just from a very practical standpoint, you know, let's say it's an image, you know, that premise is usually going to be something that you may be embarrassed about, you may be ashamed of, you feel like is going to step in the way of your potential to earn a living, your potential to get a job, your potential to have a, you know, an immigration application to be successful. You know, when people have these concerns, it's usually not frivolous. It's usually that there's quite profound ramifications.
Right.
And, you know, one of those is also this issue of revenge porn that we see a lot of. Like, that's where this idea of the right to be forgotten comes out, which is, if someone is trying to ruin your life, that's a form of digital gender violence.
Yeah.
That you should have some kind of recourse. And I think that, you know, when thoughtful, intelligent people hear that, they go, of course, that's, you know, of course, there should be some way of being able to mitigate that. What's complicated just from a very practical standpoint isn't just even thinking about, okay, the data may never get deleted from any of these places. It's that individuals can screen grab. Individuals can download things. And so
they may have it and re-upload it later.
And things get spread so very quickly that it's practically impossible to remove it once it's out there. That said, do we just put our hands up and say, okay, well, since it's impossible to delete anything, then we just won't even try? Or, you know, the repercussions or the consequences in some of these situations, you know, we're not just talking about someone who made a dumb mistake, but it can be so devastating that I think it is worth the effort to figure out what means there are in these extreme situations, in these extreme cases. So I think it's always important to not just think about this as the theoretical of like, oh, there's data, you know, and oh, okay, privacy is dead and we live in this world where everything is public and everything is recorded. But actually, if there's an emergency situation, if there's a scenario that, you know, could ruin somebody's life, don't we owe it to ourselves to start figuring out how to solve problems? Because this is our new reality. This is the world that we live in.
Does blockchain make that harder because it's distributed? I'm not sure how you would use blockchain to actually store data on the internet, for example. I understand how it works, but
that's an interesting question because I think, you know, nothing can nothing can ever, you know, you've got this permanent record of things that are there. So
maybe we should break down blockchain a little more for people who didn't understand that question.
So if the internet data is stored in a blockchain format, does it make it more difficult to go through and actually try to delete it all? Because the idea is it would be stored decentralized across many servers, many computers.
Yeah, I mean, the premise of the blockchain is that it is a permanent record. And that's where, you know, for financial records, it's so appealing is that, you know, it feels tamper-proof because you've got, you know, every different node has to approve any kind of transaction, and that transaction is permanent. You can't go and rewrite history, in other words. So that's interesting. I hadn't thought through that. I think, you know, certainly there's potential in terms of not having a corporate entity own your information. Mm-hmm. There's some interesting companies that are trying to build social networks around that premise. But I think that, look, there's good and there was bad with every, you know, we solve one problem. There's always
The good thing about a corporate entity owning it is you can sue them.
That's true.
It's one place. And you can get Google to take it down. You can get Facebook to take it down. You have some leverage over that.
Well, and you know what's interesting? This is the column that I just filed just this very morning. What is on Facebook's announced new measures to combat revenge porn. And it's interesting to hear that.
Facebook?
Yes. So here's what's interesting about all this, right? We just ended
Zuckerberg's trying hard. He's like, how do I come back from this?
Well, so, you know, here's this company that has been under a media firestorm, a government firestorm, right? In, you know, basically speaking in front of all of the major governments in the world over the past month about, you know, the misuse of private information or of our personal data. And now they're saying, this is the kicker. Basically send us your nudes. The way they're, it's a preemptive measure.
Asking people to send them naked pictures of themselves?
Basically, but I'm going to step back for a second.
So this is getting weird.
Identification.
Right, of course. Yeah, we just want to know what you look like naked.
Say it's a preemptive measure. So they actually piloted this in Australia. And it's a hashing system. So basically the idea is, this is not like, oh, hey, what are we going to do this weekend? Let's take nude shots. And just
so they're
going
to slip you some hash and then get you
just
naked.
Just in case, you know, you're not doing this
means
as
encryption,
like
encryption, Julian.
I know, I'm messing with you guys.
Like, again, this is a scenario and that they explain is for, you know, an emergency situation where you say, you know, maybe you've got an ex that has become abusive and you fear that they're going to use these images in retaliation. In that situation, you would, through a secure channel, send them the image. There's a human who reviews it. I'll get into all my questions about, you know, where this might be fraught. Uh-huh. Although I feel like, you know, the red flags are going up with each new word that comes out of my mouth.
And then
the image gets deleted. They create a hash, but there's a permanent record so that anytime anyone else tries to upload that image, it gets blocked. And it's interesting because, you know, the first response to this by the
What about if you manipulate the image somehow? You know, it's just very easy to just go in and slightly manipulate something so an algorithm can't pick up the fact that it's the same image. You see people doing this on YouTube all the time, uploading stuff they shouldn't be able to get away with. And it's got millions of views. Totally. Head swap.
There's a lot of question marks that go up along this whole process. I mean, you know, they've got a human being involved in the review process because, as we've seen countless times, you know, we can't rely on algorithms to be making ethical decisions for us or good decisions or reliable decisions
for us.
They're
just kind of stupid. They're just really fast.
The trouble with a human is that we can't rely on humans either. I mean, there's human error. Look at every time, you know, Apple is a relatively secure company and yet all their new iPhone designs always leak. And it's always because someone just like had too many drinks and left the designs at a bar or, you know, they just make dumb mistakes.
Mm-hmm. You're saying we need the singularity is what you're saying.
Oh my God. So this is a really interesting scenario in that I think that everyone's first response, all the media articles that I read about this is like, Facebook wants you to send them their nudes. Mm-hmm. And I think our first response is like all these various things that could go wrong. They've partnered with organizations.
I'm laughing that there's a list of things that could go wrong with this, as if we need a list. That's why
check,
I was laughing.
Check.
Number one, they have your naked photos.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, end of list.
And that there's a human reviewing. You know, they say they delete it within 7 days, but you know, what if things don't go according to plan? What if something happens before those 7 days? Right? Like, there's just so many questions. That said, they've partnered with a bunch of advocacy organizations in different countries. And I doing the due diligence that I had to do, reached out to it's the YWCA of Canada that they've partnered with in Canada. And I reached out to their CEO to talk through this. And it was interesting because I feel like what was missing in a lot of the analysis looking at this story, because again, it just feels like it's too obvious. Here's this company that like is just in the midst of privacy scandals saying, send us your most sensitive, most private images, right? It just feels like a trap. It just feels like a joke. That said, you know, just stepping back to the conversation we were just having around, you know, should there be these laws, these rules around the right to be forgotten and gaining control over content that may be on the internet, is what she was explaining to me is just, for starters, how pervasive this issue is, how diverse the women are, the girls are that come to them, ranging from 14-year-old girls who've got a boyfriend who is threatening to leak these images, to women who are staying in abusive marriages because, you know, maybe they're applying for immigration somewhere and their husband says he's going to leak the images. Like it just has become this digital form of power imbalance. And just speaking through how pervasive it is, that it was people from across the country, she said that they were actually the ones to reach out to Facebook 4 years ago saying we need to be developing some kind of preventative measures. And whether this is that solution, maybe I've been very long-winded in my way into it, is just nothing is clear cut. Nothing. We can't get to this level of like, is this good or is this bad? It's just so majorly complicated.
It's going to get easier. I think the problem right now is it's just like we're in the Oregon Trail days of the internet and social media still, even though it doesn't feel that way, because we've all been, you know, using social media for, you know, 10 years now. It feels like it is a part of everyday life for the most part, for most people. I don't really use it at all anymore. But still, I mean, I think it's good, even though it seems sketchy that Facebook is asking for naked pictures. I still think all of these things are progress. I'm not going to be sending them any naked pictures of myself. I don't even have any. I'm not even going to start with taking one. That's the first mistake most people make, I think. But I think also right now it's just people have so much technology at their fingertips and they're not used to it. And I think as people get more comfortable with using this stuff and they learn like, oh, don't have naked pictures of yourself on your phone. Don't just give any website your email address and password. People will start to like know these things. It'll be common sense eventually.
What's so interesting about that is we had dinner with a couple last night whose daughter is going into either the 8th or the 9th grade. And how this all applies to kids is really interesting to me, because again, we're making a lot of the decisions for them. We're sort of setting up this path for them, but they've never known anything different. And this was what was so interesting there, as I was saying, you know, I feel like all of the kind of parenting or adults versus kids in tech that was 2015, 2016 or earlier, which really wasn't that long ago, was very much set up as your kids are probably teaching you everything you know about technology. And, you know, here's this thing called Snapchat and you probably don't know how it works, but you should know how it works. Whereas I feel like now we've got, you know, millennial parents, or, you know, whether you're actually a millennial or you're kind of millennial adjacent, you're the one who's addicted to your smartphone and is on all these sort of social media platforms. So it's a very different scenario. But what was interesting about them is that particular age, I guess, of being between the 7th grade and the 9th grade, they were saying that class that's in the 9th grade now, they were the very first adopters of Snapchat and Instagram. And so there was all sorts of trouble for their year. But just a couple years later, the parents that have kids who are in the 7th grade, they themselves were users. They were seeing what was going on with the adopters, those sort of first adopters, kind of tween age. And just in a matter of a few years, the way that this age group was using the technology and the way that their parents were part of the conversation with them was so drastically different. And so I think it might get worse before it gets better, but it is interesting just to see how fast change happens as people are using these tools.
I think it's going to be really interesting to see how these kids, I mean, we all have kids in this room. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how our kids latch on to technology and how they use it in everyday life. My gut says that it's going to surprise us, that it's not going to make sense to us, because I think that's the nature of parenthood. You have one experience as a kid, and then when you have kids, you're like, I want my kid to have everything I didn't have. And then your kids grow up different than you, and you wonder how that happened. It's because you raised the opposite of yourself. It wouldn't surprise me if these kids grow up being totally okay with the singularity, like we were just joking about earlier. I'm not saying I'm a fan of it. It just seems like maybe that's a logical outcome. If you look at history, it's like, it's full of pioneers and then people that like take that progress and then run with it in a way that nobody else thought they could.
So if I may just nerd out for a moment on this idea of the singularity, and just, I think you're so right when you say that things aren't going to go according to plan. I think that's totally true with kids.
Not according to our plan.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I think not only is that true in terms of how our kids adopt things, I think it's probably going to be true when it comes to the singularity, right? So the singularity is this, right, it's the premise that we don't know what's beyond the horizon. That's the sort of underlying premise that's there.
Well, it's that we know exactly
what's
there. The
emergence of artificial intelligence, basically.
We're going to become computers.
Like, basically, what is intelligence? How does our brain work? It's just a bunch of connections. So if you throw a bunch of computer connections together in a giant network, it sounds familiar, does that...
What's the difference?
Does intelligence emerge from that? And what's interesting is we don't actually know that it hasn't already happened. The internet could, there's some corner of the internet that could already be sort of self-aware, whatever that means, right?
Yeah,
right.
And I think that just, you know, certainly media and books and film has played a large role in sort of shaping our idea of what this, you know, the robot overlords or the robots that become very, very intelligent. But, you know, I think about quite often even, you know, I joke all the time about my own self as cyborg. And when we hear about cyborgs, I think we think of like, oh, I need to saw off my arm from the elbow down and put in something that's mechanical. But I don't know about you, but I don't know my husband's phone number. It's in my phone.
Yeah. We're so reliant.
You know, we're so reliant on these tools that just because it's intelligence and not physical body parts that we have kind of outsourced to the machine. And I say all that being sort of saying, I think, you know, this idea of the singularity, I think, yeah, it'll happen, but it'll surprise us. It'll be slightly different than the image that we have of what it's going to look like. And sort of my understanding of the singularity was that moment on the horizon that you know, the horizon line is something that you can't see past, that the change is so fundamental that it just changes everything about life as we've known it. And yeah, it's probably going to happen. I think that's happened many, many times in history. But it may not be this idea of like, you know, the Will Smith movie with robots. And,
oh, yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I think,
definitely.
I think that it is just like our kids are going to surprise us. I think it's probably going to surprise us, too.
To some extent, it's already happened. This was the information revolution with the printing press. A book is basically information you can store outside your head and communicate, transfer to others, basically. It's the same thing as the internet. It's just that the internet growth has been about 10 times faster. Printing press between 1450 and about 1500 took off all across Europe. But social media and use of computers and the internet has been on such a shorter scale and reached many more people across the entire world now. So it's hard to see how that will pan out, but we have sort of experienced that before.
It's still human knowledge that these data banks are operating on. It's not like when you put a phone number in your phone and you forget what the number is. It's not like you never knew that. You had to manually enter it at some point. That's your knowledge recorded in that phone. And eventually AI is going to be running off of like all this human knowledge. So it's really no different than a book to a certain extent. It's just like a very like highly accessible form of a book.
Yeah. It's also the algorithm. Something Ramona writes about a lot is the algorithms that do the work for us. So we are using AI right now as a tool to identify your photos and tag your photos. And we know that goes horribly wrong sometimes. I think they set up a Twitter bot who became super racist after 24 hours or something like that. And they had Flickr was trying to tag photos and they tagged them with all kinds of racist tags and stuff because it's taking human knowledge and humans aren't, you know, the best creatures sometimes. We have our problems and the AI just absorbs this and applies it. It's not, AI, at least now, isn't really smart. It's basically just fast. It's like a toddler that works really, really fast.
I have the two polar sides in that I think I'm have a very utopian vision of how this technology can work, but I'm also a very dystopian vision of how it can all unfold as well. And I don't think it's a bad thing, the technology. I do think that just like the draw, that innate human draw to be on social media is the connection and each other and the social and the cuddle chemicals and all of this stuff. I think, you know, we're becoming superheroes and, you know, we are becoming smarter. We'll become healthier. Like technology is doing incredible things and it will let us, you know, it's not just social media and computers, it's healthcare. It's, you know, making us live longer. It is helping us solve problems, hopefully solving food problems and environmental problems. So no, I think that there's a whole lot of good that's there, but you know, the utopian vision often is like, oh, well, the computer doesn't have human biases. And so it will solve a lot of these issues where humans make mistakes, but that's like the fundamental, flaw in logic that we make because there is a human who has programmed that.
And
there's a human who has written
networks
it.
Taking human inputs too.
And I realize, yeah, like, you know, I realize the company that I'm in, I'm with two white guys. You guys, I think, are both very sort of open-minded liberal people and are sort of aware of the challenge is that quite often those algorithms are being written just by very homogenous group of people who aren't thinking about other people's experiences, may not be thinking about sort of like the what if, you know, that the Twitter story, it was a bot, but it became, you know, super racist, doing, you know, have Holocaust denial mm-hmm, within mm-hmm, 24 hours mm-hmm. because people were programming it. You know, mm-hmm. people were sort of.
It was a neural net, I think, wasn't it?
People want to break things, right? That is our that's our instinct when it comes to looking at new tech is like, how fast can I make that? Can I break this? Yeah. So, you know, this gets into the need for diversity in tech teams also is like, well, maybe if there was someone else who could have flagged you to what it's like to be a woman on the internet, they could have, you know, we would have avoided some of these issues, but that's another, you know, that's a kind of tangent mm-hmm. that's there. But when it comes to algorithms, this is the challenge is the utopian vision is that you've got this machine that is unbiased, that helps us be better versions of ourselves. But as long as it's, you know, being created by humans, we have to understand that it's just going to perpetuate our flaws as well.
Even if people build these algorithms with the best intentions, they're subject to hijacking by other people. So like Silicon Valley was generally pretty liberal. Most people in Silicon Valley were distraught at the Trump victory, for example, but the Trump campaign and Brexit and these sort of populist movements were the ones who really took advantage of these algorithms that Silicon Valley built. So they built them to reach lots of people, the micro-targeting, and that platform was basically hijacked by other people that these people in Silicon Valley wouldn't agree with and used to bring people apart, basically. So even, you know, they're creating tools, but the tools can be used in positive ways or mm-hmm. negative ways. You can bash someone over the head with a tool, right? So it's just a matter of how you use it.
Technology isn't a bad force because all technology does is it sells people leisure time. It gives you time to do, gives you free time. You know, that's like what agriculture is. That's what any gadget you hold in your, like the iPhone saves you like so much time.
Or sucks it up.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's what these algorithms are doing. But that's what I was going next is that what really matters is who is running these, mm-hmm. who's writing the algorithms, like you were saying, mm-hmm. Ramona, and what kind of regulation is on these algorithms, mm-hmm. I think is what this is really going to mm-hmm. come down to, because you're right. Right now, it's very easy to hijack, like with the Cambridge Analytica stuff and with the Trump thing.
The Russian bots, Russian troll farms.
Yeah, pretty much, like you said, Andrew, people want to like hijack it. They want to figure out how they can break it, how they can make it do something it wasn't supposed to do.
And how they can
hack
make
it.
Money.
Just how they can use it. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Make money or gain power.
A couple weeks ago, Amazon launched the Echo Dot for kids, which is basically Alexa for mm-hmm. minors. Mm-hmm. And it's got all sorts of child-proof content. Mm-hmm. But everything that Mark Zuckerberg has been saying at these hearings where he keeps talking about privacy settings, you were just talking about this, right? Like the privacy settings aren't, that has nothing
it's
to
not
do
really a privacy setting. No. It should be a different name. Thing, yeah. It should be a different name. It should be called sharing settings.
Yeah, exactly. The back end. So, you know, with Amazon and their little kids device now, they've said, you know, parents have the ability to, you know, they have all this control over the settings. But ultimately, the back end of the data that it's collecting is the exact same as the back end of the data that it's collecting. You know, it's just listening to everything.
Most people don't realize how hard it is to guarantee that your information is anonymous on the internet. It's almost impossible. Even if you're using Tor mm-hmm. and a VPN, it's still almost impossible to guarantee. And that's a very inconvenient way to browse the internet, Tor through a VPN.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's the challenge with when, you know, we talk about the sort of blockchain solutions to social media. It would take so long to upload a new profile photo mm-hmm. because you're waiting for everybody else to, you know, all the nodes to approve this transaction. So yeah.
Would also defeat the purpose of Facebook. So why would, I mean, I guess we could force them to give us the option of restricting who they share data with, but that's their whole business model. So obviously they're going to resist it in some way, or some other mm-hmm. entity is going to come along and try to do the same thing.
But it's kind of my concern with, you know, these devices that come out for kids is on one hand, I think they will be safer for them. There'll be less functionality that's there. They'll be, you know, designed to solve a problem. Maybe it's a call to action to the independent researchers, that a government body, an educational body, a media literacy organization. Who is it that could come up with a device that is this device that we need for our kids, but where it isn't just, you know, collecting all of their data, where there aren't these vulnerabilities, where mm-hmm. it isn't, you know, it's not going to be prey to these mishaps that you see with algorithms happening.
You're right.
Because there's, on one hand, we do want to keep them safe and they need these devices. And I think they are very convenient. They are going to, you know, we are going to rely on them, but at what cost? And
that brings us to another problem here, is that there's a lot of parents that are not, they don't care to know the ramifications of the services they're using, and especially in relation to their kids. There's not enough parents that are educating themselves on these technologies. They think, oh, Amazon came out with a product for my kid, it must be good. I think a little skepticism would go a long way, because there's anytime mm-hmm. any new device comes out, it's kind of a test. You know, it's like a to see who's going to buy it, I think. Like, everything that's coming out is new, mm-hmm. you know, so there's no real way to know how Alexa is even going to impact society yet, because mm-hmm. it's brand new, mm-hmm. let alone the one for kids. So just because somebody buys something doesn't mean you have to buy it. I think knowing what you're buying and how it operates is important,
yeah.
and not enough people educate themselves, and I think that's a big problem. You're giving yeah. these companies power.
Totally.
When you buy these things, you're giving them power, and if you don't know what yeah. it's doing, you're disrupting society for everybody else.
Anytime someone says trust me, don't trust them.
I know someone who says that a lot.
I feel like that's sort of what these companies are doing, is like it is that kind of pitch of like, oh, trust us, like this will make your lives better, this will make your lives more convenient. And I think that's, again, going back to our conversation earlier, it's not about it being good or bad. It's just like, why should we trust them? Why should we take them at their words? Let's ask some questions, let's poke some holes, and let's know what we're getting into. That said, with parents, you know, this is all so complicated. And mm-hmm. the other part that's very hard is that there's an aspect of privilege around this idea of how much we can not have our kids in front of devices, not have our kids in front of screens. You know, if you're a single parent and you're working around the clock mm-hmm. and you've got to make dinner, you need that time on YouTube to be watching your kids.
I would actually counter that. I would say that what's lacking in America is a sense of the tribe. Too many kids, Andrew and I were talking about this earlier, actually. Too many kids grow up with two parents here. And this isn't just America, it's Western culture in general. When you look at Eastern cultures, there's like these kids are raised, you could arguably, by like several adults. There's mm-hmm. several adults in these kids' daily lives. And when you look at the relationship with these kids to their parents, it's much healthier than in America. And they have a much higher respect for adults in general. And I think the problem is these kids, they grow up with two parents and they're the only adults they're used to seeing, and they just get annoyed. They're like, why would I listen to you? I'm around you all the time.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Why would I respect you? And I think so I think using technology as a babysitter is a mistake.
Yeah, but I think that's it's an easy thing to say.
Not that you're never
going to
do it. Not that you should.
But I think
Ramona's
right that a lot of people don't necessarily have that option.
I absolutely do too. You know,
but community shouldn't cost money.
Well, it's easy to say, but it's
just not.
Shouldn't cost money.
If we could get I think what we should if we could map this out on a like giant vision board, the goal would be to get to a place where we don't need to be using, you know, we don't need to be relying on, again, these giant corporations, on Amazon or YouTube
right.
being babysitters, because yeah. their intent is to make money. Right. They are not social organizations. 100%. It yeah. is not the YMCA after school swim program. It's not the rec center from the local school board, you know. They want to make cash. It's oil, right? It's the oil industry. That said, and I agree, we need community. In fact, one of the books that has been the most inspirational or pivotal books for me has been, there's a book called Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam. The premise of the book is that, you know, back in the 50s, in the era of family values, that was actually when people moved to the suburbs, they got their cars, they got their TVs, and that sort of communal aspect of the town square of community, that's when it started to erode. And we don't think about it because we think about that era being the era of family values, but it really was, you know, you moved into the suburb, you didn't really know your neighbors anymore because you were driving everywhere, you were driving into work, you got home and watched TV with your nuclear family. And I think that that's where this idea of the two parents that you talks about stems from.
You're right.
But that's where, I mean, this is something that I've argued, is that's, I think, where the drive to play World of Warcraft comes from. That's where the drive for the massive multiplayer online game
comes
from. Is I want to be part of something bigger than myself.
Yes.
And I want to, and it, that I think is very different than social media, because that is like, I'm the healer, you are the hunter, we will take care of each other. You know, if there's a group of us and we're all doing different roles and we have to rely on each other and we sort of have to be vulnerable and we all get to be a hero in a different way. See, I'm not anti-technology. I think that there's,
what you're saying
really
is we all need to play World of Warcraft after this.
I think that there's really profound lessons in some of this.
Pretty much just like killing kobolds for gold coins.
But I think that that community aspect, you're absolutely right. However, you
and
know,
it shouldn't cost money.
But we have to remember the world that we live in. And so maybe on a, you know, that's what we need to be working on, is our IRL, offline social fabric, to be mm-hmm. helping out those single moms. Because at this stage, it's very easy to say. It's very easy for me to say, like, oh, I would rather my daughter be looking into my eyes and reading a book than gazing into, you know, the twisted, corrupted, remixed version of Peppa Pig on YouTube. but not everyone has that luxury right now.
But you can start a babysitting co-op with your friends that have kids.
That's a good idea.
We all know people that have kids. Babysitting co-op. That's a great idea.
I would look after some extra kids if it meant that my kids could do the same. Yeah,
totally.
How do you feel about this stuff? We're going to open it up to the listeners. I want to hear your thoughts on your personal data, the way it's getting used, the algorithms that are dictating your digital experience, and, you know, all the stuff we covered today. We kind of covered a lot, so take your pick, leave a comment. YouTube is a great place to leave a comment if you're listening there. Otherwise, be sure to subscribe on CastBox or Apple Podcasts. It's a great place to listen, plug in some earbuds, take a walk, do some dishes, you know, multitask. Next week, we're talking to Darren Acemoglu, author of Why Nations Fail, New York Times bestseller. It's won multiple awards. Darren is a professor at MIT, head of economics, I believe. So be sure to catch that next Monday. I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. See you guys soon.